We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
Many people have seen ghosts and reported incredible experiences from the realm of the spirit world. Who can tell what this young man will see as he falls deep into a trance?
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
What's going on, everybody? Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio. It is May 30, 2014, here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. I have not been on the air, at least here, for, is it 3 weeks? I can't even remember the last time I was on the air. We got a big show tonight, though. Boy, do we got a big show. I went on a trip to the Grand Canyon with my wife. Took a week off. It wasn't really a week off. I worked the whole time, but I went to the Grand Canyon. And we had a great time, and I was planning to do a show last week, and unfortunately, life intervened. I got a call from a friend of mine. His name is Mark Jones, and been friends for a long time, and I first met him when he was going to film school at the Seattle Film Institute, and he was going to make a film for his final project. And I auditioned because I was doing a lot of student films at the time, just because it was a lot of fun. I auditioned for it and I got the role and I met Mark. And it was funny because I went in there to audition and I've got my resume. And on my resume, I had put my book of all things. Why did I put that I was a published author on my resume for a film project? I have absolutely no idea, but I did. And the book that I wrote is called Death of WCW. You can check it out on Amazon.com. A cheap plug right there. And in fact, in October, there is a 10-year anniversary edition that is going to be coming out. The book has sold nearly 50,000 copies. And one of the copies just happened to be sold to Mark Jones. And so when he saw it on the resume, he was a wrestling fan. And he went, my God, Brian Alvarez is auditioning for my film. And apparently it was not horrible. So anyway, I got the role, and it was a lot of fun, and I've kept in touch with Mark because he's a wrestling fan. So he called me a little while ago, and he just basically said, hey, you want to make a movie? You want to be in a movie? And I was like, sure, why not? I thought it was going to be a little project that he was doing, and as it turns out, this was no little project. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. It is a big production. There's a lot of money in it. A lot of work going into it, a full crew, I mean, everything. And this is a real film. And so as a result, Thursday and Friday last week and last night, I was on set all night long. I got to the set. My call time last night was, I believe, 7:30. And I did not start filming until 2:30 a.m. And I did not get home until 5:15 a.m. And the scene that I shot, I mean, trust me, it's a lot of work to, a lot of lighting to set up, all sorts of stuff to do to get a very small amount of film. So anyway, the point of this is I committed to it last Friday and then I realized there was no way that I was going to be home in time to do After Dark Radio. And so we didn't have a show last week, but here we are, we're back. And, speaking of films, next week, I Survived BTK is the topic of the show. We're going to be talking to the director of that film, also up and available on Amazon.com. I'll talk more about that later on. But that interview is already in the can. So it's all ready and good to go for next week's show. Tonight, I am very, very excited for our guest. Many years ago, I was listening to Coast AM, and a fella came on by the name of David Hatcher Childress. And he is an author. Now, I think probably most people have heard of David Hatcher Childress because he's on Ancient Aliens all the time. And at the time, I had not heard of him before. The first time I ever heard of him was on Coast to Coast AM. And he had written a series of books. And on this show, during this interview, he was talking about these Egyptian artifacts in the Grand Canyon. And to say that I was transfixed by this story is not even close to doing it justice. I don't know. I'm not a big believer in past lives or anything like that. But there's part of me that thinks, my God, what was I in a past life where I'm just so intrigued by the Southwest? Maybe it's just the fact that I'm half Mexican and my dad for a long time lived in the Southwest before I was born. I don't know how these things work, but I know that I'm fascinated by it. I've always wanted to just go down there and travel around the Southwest. And when I heard David Hatcher Childress talking about these mysterious artifacts in the Grand Canyon, I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest interview I've ever heard. And I've listened to it many times, and I always wanted to get him on the show, and I was never able to do so. And my producer, Garrett, I specifically have requested David Hatcher Childress, and about a couple of weeks ago, he said, Brian, David Hatcher Childress is confirmed. And I was so excited. I wish I would have got him on before I went down to the Grand Canyon, because we traveled from Seattle through Salt Lake City and then down to the Grand Canyon. And I wish I could have asked him, like, what are all of the great mysterious Southwest anomalies I can check out on the way down? A lot of them, to be frank, are in southern Arizona, and the Grand Canyon is kind of in northern Arizona, and we didn't go past the Grand Canyon. So I'm sure there was a lot of things down there that I even if I would have wanted to see them, I wouldn't have had a chance to see them. And of course, Keith Rowland, our illustrious webmaster, had given me some suggestions as well, but they were also farther south. So maybe next summer I'll take another trip down to the Southwest and get to check those things out. But went down to see the Grand Canyon and was just baffled. When I first heard David talking about Egyptian artifacts in the Grand Canyon, I was kind of like, well, you know, we'll talk about the story, I'm sure, on the program. But there was a story in the Phoenix Gazette, I believe in 1909, and it was a story about an explorer who supposedly had found this secret cavern in the Grand Canyon, and there was like an Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon. There were artifacts and mummies and all sorts of things in there. And I remember when I first heard it, I was just kind of like, well, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. I mean, all of these newspapers had all of these stories that they made up. I mean, there were so many made up fantasy stories in the newspapers. And this just sounded like one of them. You know, I mean, how could you possibly, I thought, hide anything in the Grand Canyon? I mean, people go see the Grand Canyon all the time. You know, I actually talked to Mark Jones about going to the Grand Canyon, and he just goes, it sucks. And I was like, oh, great. So I went down there and it didn't suck, believe me. But when I got back and we were talking about it, I mean, we both agreed the same thing. I mean, we were on the exact same page. And that is, if you've never been to the Grand Canyon and you've only seen photographs of the Grand Canyon, when you catch your first glimpse of the Grand Canyon, you are just absolutely gobsmacked at the grandeur of it. It's called the Grand Canyon for a reason. And granted, after you've seen the Grand Canyon, I mean, if you're there for any length of time, you know, been there, done that. It's a big canyon. It doesn't change much if you go 200 miles up the road. But when you first see it, I just remember looking out there and I thought, I don't even believe that I'm looking at anything real. It felt like I was looking at a painting or a photograph of the Grand Canyon. When you look at it, it's almost impossible to believe that it's real. And Mark thought the exact same thing. But anyway, when I went down there and I saw And I was reading about the Grand Canyon on the way down. I mean, I'd seen pictures and books and that sort of thing. I'd never been there. I didn't know a lot about the Grand Canyon. And when I read about how, you know, from one end to the other, going across, it's many, many miles, and it stretches like 300 miles. And when you really look at the size and the scope of the Grand Canyon, you really start thinking, man, I mean, I don't know about a whole city, but if there's something hidden somewhere in the Grand Canyon, I mean, if you're down there prospecting in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and you find a cave, and then you leave, and you try and come back and find it, I mean, I can believe that you couldn't come back and find it. I mean, it's just so enormous. So anyway, we're going to talk to him about that tonight. And the thing about David Hatcher Childress, if you head to my website, which is the After Dark Radio Show website, afterdarkradioshow.com, you can head up there and there is a link to one of David's many books. He has written 21 different books. And the key is, they're not all about the Grand Canyon. If you go to afterdarkradioshow.com, there's a link to Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest. I suggest you all check it out. If you click through that link right there, you can help support this radio show if you purchase anything off Amazon.com. So it's kind of a cheap plug, but I would like you to check out the book. I've read the book. It's if you love this subject, you'll love this book. But the point is, David Hatcher Childress has written 21 different books, and he covers everything. We will talk about, I'm sure, the mysteries of the Grand Canyon. Let me just read a couple of these titles here. He's got Lost Cities of Various Places. Here's North and Central America, Africa and Arabia. He's got a book here, Man-Made UFOs, Technology of the Gods, Pirates and the Lost Templar Fleet, The Time Travel Handbook, Mystery of the Olmecs, Yetis, Sasquatch, and Hairy Giants, The Enigma of Cranial Deformation, Flying Machines of the Ancients. Suffice to say, we got about an hour with David, but there's no way the depth of knowledge of David Hatcher Childress, the things that he could talk about, could quite frankly fill the Grand Canyon. And we've got an hour. So we're going to do the best we can, and hopefully it will go well, and perhaps someday he will be open to returning, and we can talk about all of this other stuff. But I'm very excited to have him on the show today. It's going to be a good time. So that will be coming up in about 15 or 20 minutes. As always here on this program, we are looking to hear what you have to say about all of these topics, and there are a lot of ways to do so. If you would like to contact me, we're probably going to be opening up the phone lines here in just a moment. I will throw out that number in a second, but you may contact me via email at brian@wrestlingobserver.com. That's Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, at wrestlingobserver, all one word, .com. Now, if you're going to send an email, you need to make sure that you put After Dark in the subject line. If you don't, I probably will not see your email tonight. If you send me an email, it's almost guaranteed to be read on this program this evening. It's brian@wrestlingobserver.com using the After Dark in the subject line. Make sure After Dark is there. If you'd like to contact me on Twitter, I am at Brian Alvarez. I'd like to thank everybody on Twitter. I just passed 16,000 followers. So thank you so much for that. You can contact me there at Brian Alvarez. You can put DM Radio Net. That's the hashtag. Hashtag DM Radio Net. If you'd like to contact me there, I'll be reading a lot of those as well. And the phone number is 855-478-4478 is the phone number. That is 855-478-4478. I know, actually, I'll explain this in just a moment because we've got somebody here on the line. I'll talk about the phones here in a second. We've got an upgrade, I think, but I need to test it out. So let's go to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Dave from Wisconsin.
Dave, what's happening?
Not a whole lot. Looking forward to your interview later tonight. As since Friday night, company with your show is usually an Ancient Aliens Marathon history, too, so I've been watching that pretty much all throughout the night, so looking forward to wherever you take that interview with. But I guess
actually, before you go any further, so as somebody who's watched Ancient Aliens, you have heard, you know of David Hatcher Childress.
Yeah. I thought he was a different guy at first, but then I mean, as I've been watching this more thoroughly throughout the night, but yeah, I'm a little bit familiar with him. I've not really read any books, but yeah.
Is there anybody who's more excited than David Hatcher Childress?
probably the one guy who's become a little bit.
Oh, Georgios is his name, I believe. Georgios?
Yeah, Giorgio, the guy who's the editor of Legendary Time. Other than him, I think the rest of the crew, outside of maybe, say, George Norrie, is probably, like, they're probably all on par, I would say.
I see. All right, what's on your mind?
I was just going to, in the future, I mean, I guess I'm just going to preface this. I was going to just say that I've been slightly researching things like the Beast of Bray Road, because I know you like creature stuff, and since I'm in Wisconsin, I'm actually very near the actual Bray Road.
Oh, really?
So I'm looking into actually going to visit that soon, but since I don't have much on that right now, I was just going to actually just see if you've actually watched, I'm assuming you have, but as far as ancient aliens go, like, where do you fall, like, kind of in that category?
You know, I don't know one way or the other. I'll just put it that way. But here's my thought. I feel that in general, maybe there have been visitations by aliens in the past. There's a lot of stuff that's weird. But at the end of the day, I think that ancient man is not given enough credit. Sometimes I hear things like, you know, ancient man, there's no way these Egyptians built the pyramids. It's impossible. And I'm just like, come on. You know, yeah, it would be very difficult for me to go out in my backyard and build a 450-foot pyramid. But you know what? If I had, you know, 20 years worth of slave labor, I could probably build a pyramid. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel that that ancient people are not given enough credit for what they have been able to accomplish. I'm not saying that there's zero possibility. I don't know. I would not completely rule it out. But I also don't think that anything that seems even remotely difficult must be attributed to ancient aliens. I don't subscribe to that theory.
Yeah, no, I mean, I kind of agree with you. Like, the thing is, you watch Ancient Aliens, and it really seems very compelling. Like, all the people on there are obviously very passionate about it, and they seem very convinced about it. And there's a bunch of, you know, the famous quote about, I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens. And the thing is, I also see stuff where it's that people say, well, you're not giving the ancient people enough credit. But when I watch Ancient Aliens and I see stuff like, oh yeah, this Aztec guy, he's clearly wearing a breathing apparatus, and like he's going up in a spaceship. And like, you know, that is kind of interesting. I just wish there was more detail. You know,
I need more than that. I need more than that. I mean,
exactly.
When I look at this whole phenomenon. Okay, so let's say that I woke up in the middle of the night and there was a little dude in my room. You know, my first thought would be, must be an alien, because that's what it is today. But if I lived in a farmhouse 500 years ago in Ireland and I woke up and there's a little guy at the foot of my bed, it's an elf. You know, and it goes,
right.
You know, 5,000 years ago, I wake up and there's a dude at the end of my bed, it's an angel, or however, 2,000 years, whatever. But the point is,
a fairy, whatever. Yeah,
it's whatever. Yeah, whatever the common, like whatever is our belief today. That's and when you're talking about, you know, looking at an Incan carving, and it looks like a guy's wearing a breathing apparatus, that's because we're looking at it with modern eyes. What does it look like to us? Well, it looks like a breathing. It doesn't mean it is. I mean, it may have been something very common to this culture that we really don't know anything about today. So. Yeah, I see some stuff that's interesting, but I don't naturally just jump at it having to be aliens.
Right. Okay, cool, man. Looking forward to tonight's show, so take care.
All right, thanks so much for the call. Very much appreciate that. 855-478-4478. That is 855-478-4478. Our toll-free number patches to two phone lines here in the studio. And when I signed up for it, I was unaware that it will ring 20 times, and it'll ring the first line 20 times, and then it will ring the second line 20 times. And if I have not picked up within 20 rings, it sends it to a voicemail. And I don't want a voicemail. It doesn't help. It actually makes things difficult for you, the caller. You call in, I don't answer, and you get a voicemail. I'm not going to check the voicemail. So I emailed them, because there's no option to not have it go to voicemail. So I emailed them, and I said, please just disable the voicemail. If somebody calls, just let it ring and ring and ring and ring and ring and ring. If the line is busy, have it be a busy signal. If the line is not busy, have it ring. And if it rings 20 times, just have it disconnect. Don't have it go to a voicemail or anything. Now, since that time, it does not appear I've gotten a single voicemail. So I think the phone lines are fixed. You should never get a voicemail when you call in. It'll just ring and ring and ring. When I pick it up, you're live on the air. Just like the old days on Art Bell. The phone will ring, ring, ring. When I pick it up, you're on the air. Make sure you turn whatever you're listening on, your radio, your tune-in radio, your internet, whatever it is. Make sure you turn that off, and you will be live on the air. So if you'd like to give us a call, 855-478-4478 is the phone number. I've got a couple of interesting things I want to talk about here. Discovery Channel, which is coming up on Sunday, this Sunday, there is a show called Russian Yeti, The Killer Lives. It is a two-hour special. It is premiering on the Discovery Channel this coming Sunday night at 9 o'clock p.m. What is this about? Well, many of you have probably heard of the Dyatlov Pass incident. We've talked about it many times on this show, in fact. There were a 9 college students who hiked up a mountain on or around February 2nd, 1959, and they never returned. And later they found the bodies scattered around the campsite. Some had virtually no clothing on. They had strange injuries, all dead, obviously. And for years, people have been attempting to solve this mystery. I believe the Russian government ruled their cause of death to be, what did they say? Something like a bizarre weather phenomenon or something like that. And people have been very skeptical of this. I believe at least one of the individuals tested positive with high levels of radiation. The idea that in this snowy, frigid climate, anybody would leave the tent. I mean, it appeared they all bolted into the frigid cold night, some of them without putting any clothes on, any shoes on or anything. It just an absolute terror sent them into the night where they all died. And so you can Google this Dyatlov Pass incident. We've talked about it on the show. I should probably do a full show on it. But the point of this is, for years, people have been trying to figure out what happened to these 9 college students. And this show, Russian Yeti, The Killer Lives, you can probably figure out what their idea is. And that is that they were perhaps killed by an abominable snowman. Now, this is not a brand new theory. I mean, every possible theory has really been suggested over the years. UFOs, some sort of secret weapon. A bizarre weather phenomenon has been, I mean, they've talked about, you know, the wind blows a certain way in these mountains and there's a terrible sound and it just, you know, abject terror. They fled, blah, blah, blah. A lot of different theories. One of which is that they were attacked by these abominable snowmen. Well, the interesting thing is, apparently, on this show, which is premiering on Sunday on Discovery, they have found, they claim, a photograph, one of the last photographs taken by one of the college students, appears to show a strange figure walking out of the woods towards everybody. And there are people that have seen this photograph and they say, well, it looks like, you know, somebody in snow gear. Others have said it looks, I mean, hey, maybe that's a Yeti. It's dark form coming out of the woods, scary picture. I've never heard of this photograph before. I don't know if this is new. I don't know where this, I mean, I don't know what this is. All I know is they have a photograph, which is of a strange figure coming out of the woods. And so that has led them to this conclusion that perhaps these 9 college students were actually killed by a Yeti, or perhaps there was a Yeti wailing. I don't know. And it terrified them and they ran out of the woods, whatever. But a Yeti was responsible for the deaths in this Dyatlov Pass incident. So that's coming up on Sunday on the Discovery Channel, 9 o'clock p.m. It's a two-hour special, so you might want to check that out. Now, my first question, and maybe this will be answered because I haven't seen the special yet, but my first question is, if these nine college students were attacked by a Sasquatch, a Yeti, I guess they're different. That moneymaker would probably yell at me for saying they're the same thing. But if they were attacked by a Yeti, where would the Yeti footprints have gone? They were on top of a mountain. There was snow everywhere. Don't you think that the very first thing that you would think people would see when they finally found the location where all of these bodies were scattered about, don't you think that they would have seen strange footprints? I think so. So that's my first question. If they were attacked, as this special will apparently claim, by Yeti, a number of Yeti, Yetis? Yeti? Yeti? If they were, where are all the Yeti footprints? Why haven't we never heard about them before? So it should be a very interesting show. It's coming up on Sunday, 9 o'clock p.m. on the Discovery Channel. So check that out, and I'll be looking for your feedback here on next week's program. This is not a story of monsters or UFOs or anything like that, but I got to mention this because I saw it the other day, and I was just... my jaw dropped. As all of you are aware, Google has been working on a driverless car where you jump in the car, you put in where you want to go, you hit go, and it takes you there. You don't have to do anything. Now, when I thought of the future of driverless cars, I thought that it would be something like autopilot on an airplane, where I could put in my coordinates, I could take a nap if I wanted to, but you know what? If something were going wrong, I could probably grab a hold of the steering wheel and I could land the thing if I needed to. So, first off, there is a new Google car, and it apparently has no steering wheel. That's right. It has no steering wheel. I believe it has no steering wheel, and it has no accelerator, if I recall correctly. I mean, they are taking out everything. There's no brake pedal. There's no steering wheel. And there is no accelerator pedal. So you can't control this car. You jump in the car. You put in where you want to go. And it takes you there. And you have no option if, for example, a squirrel runs out in front of your car. You can't just swerve. A squirrel is done for. Unless, I guess, these lasers are just so exceptional that they can avoid this squirrel. The only manual controls, according to the New York Times, are a stop, go button, and an emergency button. So you push a button to go, you push a button to stop, and if there's an emergency, you push a button. Now, keep in mind, there's a stop button and an emergency button. I want to know what the emergency button does. If I'm in an emergency, I want to push stop. What do I get with an emergency button? Maybe if you crash and you hit the emergency button, the police will come and they will save you. I don't know. I don't know what this emergency button is. But anyway, more importantly than this, I would like you all, without leaving the Dark Matter Radio Network, of course, to go to Google, and I want you to Google driverless car, and I want you to look at this design. It looks like something you would get in a Happy Meal. It looks to be about 6 feet long. It looks like a cartoon version of a VW bug. But there's more. I don't even know really how to. It looks like a gumdrop. And it's got some sort of sensor on top. It's got windows. It's got wheels. And the front of it, it appears to have a happy face. It is, I look at it and I just think, who would ever drive this thing? It's like you have come up with a driverless car and you've made it look like a gumdrop with a happy face on it. I just can't imagine anybody in their right mind, except like I don't know. Maybe I'm being judgmental here. Maybe everyone listening to this is going to look at this car and go, oh my God, it's the cutest car. I can't wait to get one. I look at the car and I can't imagine ever getting in it, except if it were going to take me to like the circus or to a carnival. It's the wackiest design that you could possibly come up with here for this driverless car. So I want you to Google that, and I want you to let me know what you think on Twitter. I am at Brian Alvarez. What do you think of this happy, smiling, driverless car? I should add, by the way, that this driverless car apparently has a top speed of 30. So if you're one of those people that doesn't like following slow people, just wait until you are, for example, right outside my house where the speed limit is 35 and you're stuck behind a driverless car that looks like a marshmallow with a happy face on it that's going 5 miles under the speed limit. I don't know if I see this ending well, but you can check it out yourself on Google. In fact, I think if you go to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, that is one of the stories over on the left-hand side of the page. In fact, it is. Google to build its own self-driving cars. You can click on that and you can check out this self-driving car for yourself. Once again, that is up at darkmatterradio.net. And better yet, they've got a video here. If you go to darkmatterradio.net and scroll down, afterdarkradioshow.com. If you go to afterdarkradioshow.com, hey, it may be up on artbell.com soon. Go to afterdarkradioshow.com and you can check out a video, a 3 minute and 32 second video, a ride in the Google self-driving car. So head up there and check that out. Would you ever drive one of these? Will here says, no one will ever drive the Google car. It's driverless. It's driverless? Well, why does it have a go button then? You get in and it takes you somewhere. It's like a taxi. And Phil here says, it is staring at me. Yeah, it's staring at all of us. All right, everybody. It's time. It is time to bring David Hatcher Childress onto the program. I'm very, very excited for this show. I've been wanting to do this show for years now, and I think it's going to be a good time. So we will talk to him for about an hour. And when we come back after the interview, we'll be taking more of your phone calls, emails, Twitter questions. I got more news. It's going to be a fun time. So back in just a moment, everybody, with David Hatcher Childress here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Here on After Dark Radio, Brian Alvarez here, Dark Matter Radio Network. Very excited today to be joined by David Hatcher Childress, who is the author of, at last count, 21 different books on every conceivable subject: Lost Continents and the Hollow Earth, A Hitchhiker's Guide to Armageddon, Mystery of the Olmecs, the list goes on and on, and my favorite, Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the American Southwest. David Hatcher Childress is on the show. David, how you doing?
Hey, good. It's good to be on your show.
I got to tell you this. When I first started this particular show about 4 years ago, you were on the very top of the list of people that I wanted to get on the show. I have been waiting to interview you for years now. I'm very excited about this. And I wish I would have interviewed you about 2 weeks ago, because my wife and I just took a road trip from Seattle to the Grand Canyon and back.
And oh, great.
Obviously, I've got many questions to ask you about the American Southwest. But before we go any further, tell everybody a little bit about David Hatcher Childress.
Well, I'm an American, although I was born in Europe. I was born in France and lived there until I was like 4 years old. But I was basically raised in the mountains of Colorado and the Southwest. And my dad and my parents liked to camp a lot, and we traveled quite a bit. And so I was a skier and a technical climber. Eventually went to the Himalayas, and then I had dual interests in mountaineering and camping and traveling and exploring. Plus, I also liked esoteric things and the occult. I was always into archaeology and mystical things. I wanted to go to Tibet. I wanted to go up the Amazon and search for lost cities. I think maybe as a kid I got too heavy a dose of Johnny Quest cartoons or something like that. And you know, I wanted to travel all over the world, see things, look for Yetis, look for lost cities, go scuba diving for Atlantis, all that kind of stuff. And I was fortunate in a sense that I was able to go out and do a lot of that. I taught English and in Taiwan. I was I ran a camping store in South Africa. I worked for an oil company in Sudan. I did all kinds of things, traveling around the world, and eventually I started writing my books about lost cities and ancient mysteries.
Now, I wanted to start with the Grand Canyon, but since you mentioned, several times when I've heard interviews with you, you're described as the real-life Indiana Jones. And so, obviously, the first question I have to ask is the Ark of the Covenant. What can you tell me about the Ark of the Covenant? I know there's a lot of different discussions about where it might currently be. Have you ever really, investigated this to any degree?
Well, yeah, and I do write about it in my Lost Cities of Africa and Arabia book, which came out in the 80s. I was just been fascinated by the Ark of the Covenant, of course, and by any kind of ancient technology, ancient electricity, weird devices. I'm a believer that they had electricity and even flight. My most recent book is called Vimana, and it's about Vimana aircraft, these Sanskrit machines, these that they write about in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata and all these ancient books and stuff. So, and the Bible and ancient texts are always fascinating to me, and so the Ark of the Covenant is one of those things. And you know, I'm friends with Graham Hancock. He wrote a book about it. He maintained that the Ark of the Covenant was being kept in Ethiopia.
That's right.
One of the churches in Aksum. Other people have claimed, and I talk about this in my book on Lost Cities of African Arabia, there was a guy from Arkansas who claimed that he had found the Ark of the Covenant in a cave in Jordan, for instance, near Petra. There's other stories, too, that it's underneath the Temple Mount in one of these secret passages there in Jerusalem, and we do hear about every once in a while them excavating and uncovering new things. I tend to think that something as important as the Ark of the Covenant is not something that would just be put in a cave and left there. I think that some kind of priesthood or secret society would be in control of it, know where it is, keep it in a kind of a secret place and in custody, in a sense. And that is what Graham Hancock is saying about the Ark of the Covenant in Ethiopia, that it is being guarded by this special priesthood and stuff like that. That Ark of the Covenant, I think, is a copy of the original, and they talk about that. King Solomon, too, the whole story of the Ark of the Covenant and his many treasures and things that he did, according to the Kebra Nagast, the ancient Ethiopian text, King Solomon supposedly met with the Queen of Sheba, who was from Ethiopia, and they ruled over Yemen at that time, too. And they had a child together who later became the Menelik I, the first what they call Solomonic ruler of Ethiopia. And in the Kebra Nagast, it talks about King Solomon going to Ethiopia to visit the Queen of Sheba and his son that he had with her, and that he flies in an airship and covers what would take them normally a whole week by caravan down through Arabia. He does the whole thing in one day, and it talks about that. So the whole idea that even King Solomon had one of these ancient flying machines and that he could fly around, I mean, it's part of course, the ongoing UFO enigma and the whole story of people seeing UFOs in the past, and that gets into, of course, the ancient aliens whole concept. But I'm definitely a believer in ancient technology and the Vimanas. They had these machines. They had electrical devices in Egypt. They also had these they had electrical devices that they lit temples with. And I talk a lot about that in my book called Technology of the Gods. Maybe you've seen that one.
Yeah. Now, the Vimanas, my understanding is that they're, I mean, one could theorize that these are just fantasy stories that people wrote back in the day. But, I mean, there are models and drawings of very strange things that appear to be. I know there's at least one golden model of what appears to be like an airplane. And right. And they've talked to, aerodynamically, this thing, if you blew it up, would actually fly, they say. What kind of evidence do we have that there actually were Vimanas and it was more than just like fantasy stories?
Well, when you're talking about like the gold airplanes, which there was a number of them, and they're at the Gold Museum in Bogota, Colombia, with a lot of other gold artifacts, and they are exactly like Saab, Delta jet fighters, and things like that. Gold is indestructible. All the gold of ancient times still exists today, and when you make something out of gold, which is generally jewelry, some electronic things are made out of gold too. They will last, and they can't really be destroyed. I mean, the objects that the gold is part of can be. So you have these like gold. And they're just small pieces of jewelry, but they are of airplanes or what appear to be airplanes. The archaeologists have to explain this because they're real, and their explanation is, well, it looks like an airplane, but it's not really. It's a bee, or it's a flying fish, or it's just a bird. Although these things have tails like jets that come up, and no fish or bird has a tail like that. And even the cockpits of these things are different. And there's pictures of these in my books and in Technology of the Gods and things like that. The problem is that you can't make machines out of gold, and so machines are, and these things have to have electricity. I mean, real genuine flight needs electric power. There's got to be motors there. There's got to be some kind of electricity, wings of some sort, or some kind of gyro UFO flying saucer craft. But those things can't be made out of gold. They have to be made out of steel and iron, metals and things like that will rust and oxidize. People have often said, well, I'm looking for this Atlantean Mercedes out in the desert that's been sitting there for 10,000 years, but, well, can't find it, so it must not exist. Well, things like that aren't going to exist. They'll be destroyed. When I lived in Sudan, and I used to drive a Land Rover around in these oil fields and stuff, right now where they're fighting this war, and I knew that if I left my Land Rover there and if it broke down, if I came back a week later, it wouldn't be there. People would have literally stripped it down, taken all the metal parts and then turned them into spears and daggers and stuff. And I've seen this happen. So you can't just leave these valuable machines made out of metal lying around. The first person who comes along is going to take it just because the metals are valuable. So now you have the whole concept of these halls of records, secret repositories, something like the Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado Springs, where the American military has hollowed out this mountain. There's a high-tech city inside of it with electric cars and their own generators, and there's dormitories and cafeterias and scientific labs. But we can't go in there. I mean, it's a secret military facility. The government admits it exists, and it's inside of a mountain. But we can't ever go there. We just kind of know the vague stories of that. And I mean, even there can be these underground trains going through the earth, connecting Los Alamos labs with Cheyenne Mountain and things like that, and down to the Albuquerque Sandia labs and the Air Force Base there. And there's rumors of these being tunnels and underground bases, people hearing tunnel boring machines going through the earth. Well, and that's today. But we could have this same kind of thing could be happening in the past. And so you have stories like Mount Shasta in Northern California. It's very, the whole legend and lore of that, Mount Shasta, is very similar to Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado, where you have supposedly a city inside of a mountain. UFOs come out of this Lemurian or Atlantean or extraterrestrial city that's ancient. I mean, it's 10,000 years old or more. It's underneath the earth. It's buried. It's inside of a mountain. And the whole idea is that in certain places like this, at Mount Shasta, places in the Andes in South America, places in Tibet and other places, you have these secret repositories, places where these ancient machines are kept. They still have some of these ancient devices, crystals and high-tech computers that are created out of crystals are part of it. I mean, the whole thing, it gets pretty fantastic. And it's like when you read the ancient Hindu epics, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, and all that. They're like the wildest science fiction. They're like Buck Rogers, the Flash Gordon, flying around. They have these airships. They have these terrible weapons. They're blasting each other. They have these devastating wars. And it's very clear in those ancient texts that people are genuinely flying in machines. And these machines have weapons and other kinds of special devices on them. Even there's a whole book in India called the Vimanika Shastra, which is a technical manual for these Vimanas. So how about that?
Now, has anybody actually like looked through that manual? I mean, does it have like, here's how they're created, here's what they fly on, here's how you make one? What is in the technical manual?
It is in that manual, although it's very obtuse, trying to figure out the whole thing. He talks about poles. The whole thing gets really technical, and he talks about different kinds of metals and all kinds of stuff. Maharishi Bhadwaja, the wise, was supposedly the guy who wrote this book, and it's a controversial one. In my book, Vimana, there's a whole chapter where I run down the Vimanika Shastra book, which is this instruction manual, and go through it chapter by chapter, really. And trying to make sense of it is difficult. And honestly, Sanskrit scholars themselves have been critical of the book, saying, like, yeah, you can't make anything from this. It doesn't make sense to them. And that's all fine. The idea that you're going to have some technical manual written in ancient Sanskrit and then it's going to be translated into some, you know, highly technical drawings of these airships, that's just not really going to happen. But what we can glean from this text is some sort of idea of like what they're talking about. And even there's different kinds of Vimanas they talk about. There's over 5 different kinds. Some Vimanas were like airplanes with wings and just like a normal airplane. Others were more like helicopters. Some were more like Zeppelins, big tubular type airships. And one type of Vimana was like a flying saucer, and it was a circular design. And it probably flew like a flying saucer flies too, which is some kind of anti-gravity, an electrical craft. Something else that I write about a lot in my books is the work of Nikola Tesla. And Tesla's one of my heroes. I'm always glad to see his name get out there because he's a suppressor.
It has gotten out there a lot more in recent years.
He certainly has, and that's great. And the Tesla car company and things like that. We need this. And it's so important to look at Tesla's work in terms of Vimanas and UFOs and even our space program and the so-called secret space program, all that kind of stuff. If Tesla were alive today, he died in 1943, right in the middle of World War II, and there's some talk that he also was, in fact, assassinated. We don't really know. But Tesla would be very, very critical of today's space program. And the whole idea that we have to go into space by lighting a giant firecracker under our ass and going into space like Wile E. Coyote when some, you know, flying bomb that's, you know, could explode and kill us all on our way into space, that is not how aliens would be coming to our planet. It's not how Nikola Tesla would have designed our space program. To Tesla, space travel and spaceships and everything, they should be electric. Everything to him was electric. So he was the creator of alternating current that we use today. He had these towers that he was going to build, and they were going to broadcast electricity into the atmosphere, just like a radio station. He had these anti-gravity airships that were also like these big Zeppelin type tubular cigar shaped mothership type things. They would draw power for their electric motors, and he invented all this stuff back in the 20s. The Electrical Experimenter magazine of the time would have articles every month about these amazing inventions that Tesla was creating. At the time, he was a very, very famous person. But yet, it's nearly 100 years later, and these things, these inventions have not surfaced. We're going into space in these firecrackers that are so dangerous. And the space program itself is like basically made it so that we don't even think there's some alternative. I mean, if you want to go into space, you've got to go in some kind of rocket. And then, therefore, UFOs, what are they? Well, they can't exist, or, of course, they must be from some other planet, because they're not rockets. They're not jets. They're something else. They're electric. They're anti-gravity. They're flying gyros or something. And, you know, they're not some chemical bomb that's, you know, blowing through the universe and then crash landing on our planet. And that's kind of the same thing with Vimanas. That what are talked about in Vimanas is that they're high tech. They have bright lights like UFOs. They're anti-gravity. They're spinning. They have all kinds of special metals and even crystals and things like that in them. They are electric. They have computers. I mean, the whole thing is pretty fascinating, and with all this kind of stuff, and what I write about, it's how you see the past. What we're being taught by our high school teachers and college professors, and then what we see on TV, except on shows like Ancient Aliens, is that, oh, yeah, you know, they were cavemen 10,000 years ago, and people didn't even, you know how to get into a boat and go anywhere. And then slowly over the last 10,000 years, we've built giant pyramids, huge cathedrals, and things like that. And then in the last 100 years, mankind has managed to have electricity and flight and all these things, and they're totally new. I mean, we've just discovered them now for the first time back in 1890 or something. And, you know, that never existed before. But yet, basically anything that we could create now, ancient man could do that too. There's nothing to stop them. They had the same kind of curiosity and intelligence and drive and sense of adventure that we have today. But you need metals. You need to understand science. You need electricity to do all these things. And what I argue in my books is that, yes, they had all this stuff. And in fact, to move these giant megalithic blocks and cut and carve them, you're going to need some pretty high-tech stuff. And that's what I found going all over the world with the Lost Cities and on the Ancient Alien show, too, is looking at some of these gigantic structures made with 100-ton, 500-ton, 1,000-ton blocks of granite and stuff like that. How are they going to do that? I mean, even today, you stand there in Peru or in Egypt or Lebanon or one of these megalithic buildings around the world, and you think, wow, how did they do that? How could they put this together and so perfectly when even today, a modern construction company with cranes and heavy building equipment couldn't really do what they did in the past? And yet they're supposedly more primitive than us. It doesn't make sense, and so it's a paradox.
You know, one of the things that I've always found interesting is the idea that the traditional idea that in the past, if you were a seafaring nation or whatever, you had to remain localized. You know, the fact that, oh, you know, if you just the idea that you couldn't travel great distances over the ocean. What kind of evidence do we have for pre-Columbian visitors to this country?
Well, I mean, right. The whole idea that people can't get into a boat and go somewhere, that oceans are barriers, that, you know, they stop people from traveling. I mean, that is completely unscientific. Oceans are highways, not barriers. The easy way to go someplace is to get into a boat and go there, whether it's across an ocean or across a sea like the Mediterranean or even if you're just going from island to island, like through Indonesia or something like that. That's how you go places. It's the easy way. But today, particularly in the United States, yeah, it's like a Orwellian doublespeak where oceans are barriers. Everybody coming to the Americas, they have to walk here. They've got to walk across some land bridge.
That's right. Impossible they could have come over the ocean.
And then walk thousands of miles through hostile tribes to get to South America, and then, you know, found their little sun kingdom or whatever they want. I mean, but in reality, going by places in a boat is much safer, it's faster, it's easier. And people have been going by boat for over 20,000 years. So the whole idea that Columbus was the first person to cross the Atlantic and come to the Americas, I mean, they know that's wrong. But all the scholars will do is say, oh, well, yeah, there was some Vikings who made it to Labrador or something like that, but, you know, it's no big deal, and then Columbus showed up. Well, the flip side of that is literally every culture in the world with a boat could have come to the Americas, probably did come. Gavin Menzies, who's this author and historical scholar, he's written a number of books about how China and their navy circumnavigated the entire globe back in the 12th century, hundreds of years before Columbus. And ultimately, what we're talking about is people like Sumerians and Egyptians, Romans, Jews, Chinese, Africans. Everybody with a kingdom and a fleet of ships could cross the Atlantic or the Pacific and come to these areas, and they're trading and stuff like that. The big time bomb for this whole field is a ceramic bowl that's today in the museum in La Paz. It's in the Gold Museum, which has been closed for the last year or so because of attempted burglary to get into this museum and steal the gold artifacts are there. But the Fuente Magna Bowl, this ceramic bowl, is there in the museum. It was found near Lake Titicaca in 1960, and in fact, they traded a house to the local guy whose land this bowl was found on. And there's other artifacts were found there too. But here's the kicker: this bowl has two forms of Sumerian writing in it. It has Sumerian hieroglyphic writing and Sumerian cuneiform, and the Sumerians wrote and had various forms of writing. And cuneiform is one of them. And cuneiform is on the inside of this bowl, and that bowl is in the museum in La Paz, and this is the government museum. Well, okay, how can that be? Now, the mainstream archaeologists would say this is impossible. There cannot be a bowl with Sumerian writing found in Bolivia. I mean, it can't be there because the Sumerians couldn't have ever gone to Bolivia. They would have had to have boats, even airships like Vamanas or something. But let's say they had boats too, of course. Just like today, we have airships, we've got spaceships, but we still use ships and boats for a lot of our cargo. So just be having airships doesn't mean you're not going to go places in boats too. So how can that bowl be there? I mean, the mainstream, That bowl cannot be there, and it can't have Sumerian writing on it, but it's there. It's in the museum. What can the mainstream do now about it? Nothing. And in fact, all they can really do is what they're doing, and that is ignore it. You won't see a National Geographic special on that bowl in Bolivia. They're not going to do it. The powers that be would say, no, don't go there and feature that bowl. Now, a renegade show like Ancient Aliens, yeah, they'll go there. And that is an episode. We show the Fuente Magna Bowl. You can see it. You can see the Sumerian writing on it. It's all there. And that right there is proof that Sumerians traveled around 3000 BC to South America. It's right there. And it's in a national museum. But all the powers that be in the United States, the professors, they're just going to ignore it and say, no, we haven't been to that museum. We're not going there. We're not going to talk about that. And that's what they do. It's like Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. The very end of that movie, is Indiana Jones asking his boss in Washington, D.C., where's the Ark of the Covenant? I want to see it. Where is it? And at the very end of the movie, he says, don't worry, top men are working on it. Top men. But you're not going to ever see it again. And the last scene of the movie is this giant warehouse where they're putting the Ark of the Covenant in a big crate into this warehouse, and no one's ever going to see it. And, you know, years ago, that's a 1983 movie, and people have often asked me, why would there be archaeological cover-ups? Why would they cover things like this up? And that's a good question and, you know, deserves a good answer, but they do have reasons for covering up archaeological things, and I'm convinced that they do.
Now, the Smithsonian brings us to the Grand Canyon. The supposed, I don't know if it's a full Egyptian city or Egyptian artifacts. All I know is, this is going to sound kind of wacky, but before I'd gone to the Grand Canyon, I was completely unaware of the scope and the size of the Grand Canyon. I expected it to be big, but I did not expect it to be absolutely as gigantic as it was. And once I saw it with my own eyes, I was like, you know, maybe there could be a place down there where there could be, I don't know about a full city, but Egyptian artifacts. Tell us the story of the supposed Egyptian artifacts found in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. It all comes from a 1909 newspaper article that was written in the Phoenix Gazette, and there was a follow-up article, too. And the 1909 Phoenix Gazette article talked about an explorer named Kincaid. He was coming down the Grand Canyon at that time, 1908, 1909. There was a lot of exploration in the Grand Canyon, mainly miners and prospectors. And in fact, there are gold mines and other mines in the Grand Canyon. I've got a book about it. It was pretty interesting. So Kincaid was coming down the Colorado, and it was right around the area where the Little Colorado and Canyon and river meets the Big Colorado Canyon, and that's near a place called Tanner Trail and stuff. What he did was he looked up, according to the article, and he saw what he thought was a mine and mine tailings coming down, and it was way up high on the cliffs of the Grand Canyon. He was down on the river. So he very difficultly climbed up to this cave, which he thought was a mine, and it would be an ancient mine, too. And that's a lot about a lot of ancient mining and metals and stuff like that, which I write about in my Lost Cities of Southwest book, is that, yeah, you have these ancient mines, and then they're rediscovered, and sometimes they're pretty fantastic. What they found in the Grand Canyon, though, was, rather than some ancient mine, as they described it, was a catacombs of cut rooms and passages cut deep into the solid rock. And so, in a sense, it was like a city, but it was all underground and cut through solid sandstone, and then there would be rooms, and in these rooms were statues of swords and spears, metal things. They were described as looking very Egyptian, also described as looking kind of Tibetan and Oriental. There were mummies and things like that in these caverns. What these caverns and this so-called city were a lot similar to is the Valley of the Kings near Luxor in southern Egypt. A lot of people think that mummies in Egypt are found in pyramids. Well, in fact, they've never found any mummy in any pyramid in Egypt, in fact. But they have found lots of mummies, but they find them in these rock-cut vaults, like the Valley of the Kings. And they are cut through solid rock. They're in a desert canyon, similar in a way, but much smaller than to the Grand Canyon. And this is where King Tut's tomb and all that kind of stuff is. And they're cut also into solid rock, and then they go into different rooms. There's mummies, there's artifacts in there. And that's kind of what's being described in the Grand Canyon. Now, the Phoenix Gazette story in 1909 also went on to talk about the Smithsonian Institution and how they had sent one of their archaeologists, and they name him as Jordan. And so people are being named, the Smithsonian's part of it. They talk about Jordan is really excited about this find. Again, they describe these statues and artifacts that are in this cave in the Grand Canyon. And then the end of the story is that they're going to take all this stuff back to Washington, D.C., and back to the Smithsonian. And that's the end of the story. And it seems very much like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where these things were sent to the Smithsonian, but then they vanished. And no one's ever to see them again. We don't know. We can't see these mummies. We can't see these artifacts. Presumably the Smithsonian got them. But when you contact the Smithsonian, they say, oh, no, we don't have any of this. And, of course, the official line is that, yeah, this is all fantasy. The newspaper's editor was bored one day. He just made up this elaborate story, naming people, naming the Smithsonian, naming scientists, and that, yeah, none of it ever happened, and the Smithsonian is scratching their heads going, we don't know. And look, if you go to the Grand Canyon today and talk to rangers, they don't know. They've never even heard this story. But here's part of the thing with the Grand Canyon, like what you were just saying. It's a huge, vast area. And
it's like 300 miles.
You can't just go backpacking and hiking to the Grand Canyon. Forget it. You need all kinds of permits. Rangers are watching every trail. They'll check your permit if you're not supposed to be there. And it can take years to get certain permissions to go through the Grand Canyon, to go on some river boating. So even, and then there are areas of the Grand Canyon that I found out that are totally off limits. There are areas of the Grand Canyon that have big steel locked doors and gates over mines and tunnel entrances. So it, in my mind, I think that there's totally something to this story, and that the Smithsonian is covering it up. But I think that it's so many years have gone by now that the original people who did the cover-up, I mean, they're long gone. And there might be a few people at the Smithsonian who are somehow aware of this, but it's more like something just now lost to history.
Now, there were many newspaper articles back during that period, which were exactly as you explained. An editor got bored, he made up a fanciful story. I mean, there's tons of them back from that period. But you have tried to investigate, because names, I mean, there were names given in this Phoenix Gazette story. And you've tried to trace some of these names, and you found a few of them, correct?
Yes, right. And the whole story, I mean, it gets stranger and stranger, and more people start appearing in it. Another character who's not mentioned at all in the Phoenix Gazette story is a guy who's famous around the Grand Canyon. His name was Seth Tanner, and he was a Mormon prospector who came down from Utah, and he lived around the Gallup and Tuba City and Cameron and Grand Canyon area, and he was actually married to a Hopi woman and even had a Navajo wife too. And in fact, a number of the trails and crossings around Cameron and in the Grand Canyon, they're named after him. Tanner Trail is a famous trail in the Grand Canyon. Tanner Crossing is a famous crossing of the Little Colorado near Cameron. Well, Seth Tanner has an interesting story, and there's a photograph of him in my book. He also, while prospecting in the Grand Canyon, he came across some kind of secret cave, a secret place that the Indians knew about, but it wasn't for any Europeans to ever see. But he went there and saw it. And because of that, Indian tribal councils of the area, they sentenced him to death. But because he was married to a couple of Indian gals, they decided, okay, let's not kill him, but we're going to blind you for what you saw. And they threw some kind of acid in his face, blinded him. And it's famous that throughout his life, and the photos taken of him, he's this bushy old guy, and he's blind with these white eyes. There's a photograph of him in my book. And he was well known, and he would sit around Cameron. Today, his family still runs the Tanner Trading Post in Gallup. And I went and talked to them one time. They were fascinated by this whole story. And, in fact, Seth Tanner, that guy, appears in this great Western from the mid-60s called McKenna's Gold. And as a kid growing up in Colorado, I saw my share of Westerns, and I saw that movie. Gregory Peck is a sheriff. Edward G. Robinson plays Seth Tanner in the movie, but they also, in McKenna's Gold, they're in the same area of the Grand Canyon. They go to a secret city. There's a lost treasure. This guy, Seth Tanner, the blind man, is also part of the book. So the more I looked into the whole story, the more real it got. And I kept finding other people who could talk about this and that you could plug into the Phoenix Gazette story. Another weird thing about the Grand Canyon is that the names of many of the formations are Egyptian names. And for whatever reason, the early explorers in the Grand Canyon decided to name everything with some kind of Egyptian or Hindu name. And the names are things like Isis Temple and Pyramid of Cheops. Also, some are called Shiva Temple and things like that. So you have to wonder exactly why these guys were even giving them all these Egyptian names and stuff if they hadn't already found what they thought was Egyptian kind of things there in the Grand Canyon.
Now, did Seth Tanner ever talk about what he saw in these caverns?
You know, he never really did, and there's no real record of him writing a book or, like, his own story. There's just kind of stories of him in the Grand Canyon lore. In order to find out about him, you have to buy these books that are basically about the history of the Grand Canyon, and he's in there. I mean, when it comes to early Grand Canyon stuff, he's a very important figure and a mysterious one. And for some unknown reason, and this is absolutely true, he was blinded for seeing some secret thing in the Grand Canyon. We don't know what it is, but we assume it's this so-called city inside the Grand Canyon.
Now, I want to know more about this Cheyenne Mountain. Speaking, because I mean, you've written a lot about underground cities and caverns and such. I mean, what do we know about Cheyenne Mountain? I mean, you mentioned a little bit about it. You know, it's a government facility, but I mean, what do we know about it?
Well, we know it's the NORAD Central Command for North America, which basically means Canada and the United States, and it's. So the idea that Russian or Chinese or somebody's missiles are suddenly headed for American cities, they're going to control it all from inside that mountain. What's inside that mountain, which is fantastic and fascinating, is that there's some kind of city in there. I mean, there's a total futuristic city of electric cars and electric trains and whatever's down there has got to be the most modern and advanced. Absolutely, there's secret military stuff there. And what's kind of interesting is that we know that Cheyenne Mountain completely exists and is this underground city, but the question is it linked to other underground bases, such as the Dulce, New Mexico base that's kind of legendary, even to Los Alamos Labs, which are just west of Santa Fe, on down to the big Air Force base in Albuquerque and Sandia Peak. People claim around Albuquerque, it's the same thing at Dulce, New Mexico, which is just south of the Colorado border, and that's quite near to the Cheyenne Mountain area. This is also the area where all these cattle mutilations and stuff was going on in the 70s and 80s. So what people have claimed they have seen coming out of Sandia Peak and at Dulce is jet planes and UFOs coming out of the mountains. And so the idea there is that they have these secret hangars. They're also inside a mountain. These hangars are cloaked with a holographic wall. Even they would have hangar doors, but they look totally exactly like the mountain. But these doors open up, and then a jet fighter just comes shooting straight out of the mountain, or alternately, some kind of flying saucer craft flies out of there too. So here you have we know that they have some of these underground bases, and the government even admits that. But it's just how extensive they are, and are they connected with some kind of underground, you know, maglev train system that takes you through the earth? And that's what, you know, seems fantastic to people. But
well,
I think
let me ask you about that, because there are many reports of people that have stated, like, there's always been like every now and then I'll hear a weird rumbling underground. There are a lot of reports of strange noises in certain towns. That just
absolutely, and in fact, there were in that area. There was the famous, this went on for years, it was called the Taos Hum. And Taos is another area just north of Santa Fe. And so you're in this, if you were to draw a line from Cheyenne Mountain to Los Alamos, and it would go through Dulce area and then go down to Albuquerque, it would go right near Taos. And so for years, people who lived in Taos kept complaining. And it was in the newspapers and stuff there that they were hearing this weird rumbling and humming noise deep underground. And, you know, the military and the government said, oh, well, we don't know anything about that. Well, we'll look into it. And, you know, in the end, it all just went away. But apparently what they were hearing were these giant tunnel boring machines deep underground that were boring, you know, a tunnel kind of somewhere near Taos on their way to some other underground base. I mean, look, this makes total sense. It's only natural that the government would be doing this. It is a secret thing. It's cost a lot of money. This is black budget program for sure. Who knows what the cost of all this is? But part of it is, you know, I'm convinced it's part of their own secret projects. They have UFOs. They've got discoid craft. They've got flying triangles. They've got anti-gravity. These things are electric. They're not like a jet or a rocket. They're Tesla-type technology. And so, you know, that they would be doing this, it only makes sense. And at least part of the UFO enigma is a technology cover-up. It has to do with the military. It's top secret devices and aerospace things that they have that they're keeping a secret. And it's because of the military, you know, they're trying to protect us. I mean, they say that the military is about 50 years ahead of normal consumer products. So, yeah, just think of that. What we're going to have in 50 years' time is what the military already has. How about that?
You know, if you added up every single report of a UFO over the course of a year, I mean, there would be thousands and thousands and thousands. And I think that even the most open-minded individual would suspect that it's very unlikely that thousands and thousands of UFOs would be visiting this planet on any given year. You know, a lot of people, they're mistaken natural phenomenon. I guess my question to you is what percentage of UFO reports, just a vague number, what percentage do you think are mysterious government craft that are being test flown?
Well, I think a high percentage is that. And, I mean, when it comes to this whole topic, one thing is for sure, that the military is totally interested in this. They want to know about UFOs. They want to know what the power source of a UFO is. They want to know where they came from. They want to know the technology behind it. I mean, they are interested. And I think for a lot of UFO investigators, they often are a little bit nonplussed by the fact that the government doesn't seem to be that interested in these UFOs. And they're like, well, don't worry. The Phoenix Lights, for example, back in 1999, and a lot of people, including the governor of Arizona, saw this giant triangle flying over Phoenix, and it flew very slowly. And people videotaped it, books were written on it. I mean, anybody who saw it was very, very excited about it. It just was something from another planet, and because it was so big. And it just flew very slowly over Phoenix, coming north up to near where I live. Well, when they talked to the American government about it and the military, you know, they weren't concerned. They're just like, oh, no, it's some flares. It's nothing. No big deal. Don't worry about it. So the UFO people, I mean, you either have to conclude one of two things. I mean, first of all, you know that something really happened there, and it probably wasn't just some flares. But you have to wonder, like, well, is the government really not interested in this? Or, you know, well, this was aliens flying over Phoenix and surveying it, and the government didn't even scramble jet fighters after it or anything like that. And you wonder, you know, why would that be? Well, they're just afraid of the aliens. But the other thing you might conclude is that the government knew all about that flying triangle, was in control of it the whole time, had it on their radar. They could have scrambled jet fighters after it at any point. But why would they? That was their own craft. You know, they're not going to scramble jet fighters after one of their own special test craft. So that's the other thing you might conclude. So the other thing to think about with certain UFO things is all the stories of UFO crashes. And the idea that extraterrestrials would navigate the vast reaches of space and come here from another galaxy even, let's say, and then come here, but then they would crash. And they can't fly across New Mexico without crashing. And then, you know, the advanced extraterrestrial mothership doesn't even come and get them. So you're kind of wondering, it's a paradox of technology. In other words, they have this super technology that allows them to go fly intergalactically from planet to planet, but yet they can't even fly across the planet without crashing.
That always was my big question whenever Roswell is discussed. I mean, the idea that a craft would come here from God knows where, and the first thing that happens is it gets hit by lightning and crashes. It's kind of like...
Well, and the story is that radar shoots it down. So they can't, you know, what doesn't hurt our craft and just models it actually, you know, shoots down extraterrestrials. So, but here's now the flip side of that. Let's say that the American government has been making UFOs and has been since World War II or the early 50s, whatever, and that they're making them, and whether they can still be back engineering, you know, extraterrestrial craft or technology they've somehow gotten, whatever. But if they're making their own craft, those are going to crash, you know, because they're not intergalactic high-tech craft. They're experimental craft. You would think there would be a lot of crashes of those craft, because they've got a lot of bugs to work out of them. And whether there were small, little, three-foot aliens inside these craft when they recover them, you know, who knows? Maybe that's the cover story. In other words, there needs to be a cover story. So think about that for a second. You've got a flying saucer that crashes somewhere in New Mexico, and a rancher goes out and finds it, and it's in the newspaper the next day, flying saucer crashes, blah, blah, blah. Now the government, the military's they have to scramble for some cover story. So the two cover stories, it's like a magician, you know, look over here, look over there. The two cover stories are both cover stories. One is that nothing happened. It was a weather balloon. It's just, you know, just people thinking a flying saucer crashed when it didn't. Or the other explanation is, yeah, it was a flying saucer that crashed, but it's a bunch of aliens from some other galaxy, you know, and they crashed. So the real story, which is that it's one of their prototype craft that they're not supposed to have, and, you know, no one has something like this except aliens, then that must be the story. So the real truth is covered up, in a sense. And a lot of people don't see that. Even your UFO investigators prefer to think that, yeah, these are aliens crashing a ship. And I don't know. I believe the government does have their own crafts, and I think some of them must crash occasionally. And so that may well be the Roswell crash too, and there's other UFO crashes as well.
Now, since we're on the subject of aliens and such, the Blair cuspids on the moon. Tell everybody about the Blair cuspids.
Well, yeah, the Blair cuspids were discovered by a British amateur astronomer of a sort back in the mid-60s. He was going over Soviet photos of the moon, and what he noticed were these obelisks on the moon with these big, long, narrow shadows that were being cast. And the Soviets got very interested in it, too. He first wrote about it in an astronomy magazine in England. And so they were called the Blair cuspids. What they are these obelisks. They are a group of like five very tall, narrow obelisks. They're at this part of the moon. The Soviets did a whole special investigation, and I do write about that, this too, in my books, like Atlantis and the Power System of the Gods and stuff. And so it's fascinating, too. In many of my presentations, I talk about obelisks. They're a whole mystery in themselves. Obelisks are monolithic granite towers. They weigh about 100 tons. why the Egyptians and other people even put obelisks up. We don't know why. But Tesla had a whole system of these antennas and towers. I surmise that these obelisks were part of some ancient power system like what Tesla was trying to create. And what's incredible is that apparently obelisks are not just on planet Earth, they're on the moon too. And apparently we're probably going to find obelisks on Mars as well.
Now, you mentioned the obelisks and such in Egypt, and I actually wanted to ask you this earlier, since you mentioned halls of records. Do you believe that there is a hall of records under the paw of the Sphinx?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if there's something like that. And Edgar Cayce, the famous sleeping psychic from Virginia Beach, he talked about this in one of his readings, and he mentions the paw. That, too, you would almost wonder, and there are accusations of this, that the Egyptian government has discovered some kind of secret rooms under the Sphinx and that they're covering it up. Of course, they maintain they're not doing that. But that may well be. I've been to the Sphinx a number of times. They have done some weird work there. There is also a tunnel system that's underneath the Sphinx and going towards the pyramids. And if there's water there. It's cut into solid rock. It's a little bit like the Grand Canyon catacombs we were talking about, where they're just cut straight back into solid rock, and there are these tunnels. There's areas of the Giza Plateau where you can see some of these tunnels. There's a place called Campbell's Tomb, which is a shaft that goes straight down, and it's about a 20-foot by 20-foot square shaft cut into solid rock, and it goes straight down for about 100 feet, and the Egyptian government has a huge metal grate over it so that tourists won't fall down into it. But you can see little tunnels and passages going off from the side from it. So there absolutely is some underground world underneath the Giza Plateau and the Sphinx. And exactly what's down there, it wouldn't surprise me if there's some kind of hidden, you know, place of records or something like that. There's other places, too, in the Himalayas. And I write about this in my new book on Vimana, how you have these secret fortresses and secret mountain areas of Tibet and Western China and Mongolia. You have similar things, I think, in South America around Lake Titicaca and other areas of the Andes. There are reports of secret tunnel systems. I write about that, too, in my book, Lost Continents of the Hollow Earth. And I've been inside some of these tunnel systems, particularly in South America, and they're real. I can't claim I've ever followed one, you know, for days to some underground city or anything like that, but the tunnels are there, and exactly who built them, where they go, they might just be tunnels from ancient mining, but, I mean, the tunnels themselves are real, and there's a big lore and legend that goes along with them, including fantastic lost treasure, tunnels going for literally hundreds of miles through the Andes Mountains and stuff like that. I mean, it seems pretty far-fetched, and yet there's something there. I'm convinced.
Now, a lot of people would think that there was an age of exploration. We mapped the entire world. We've got this Google Maps system right now. There are no unexplored places left in this world. That's...
Well, right, yeah. I think people do think that, and with Google Maps is, you know, sort of kind of mapping the world. But in fact, if anything... There's more things being discovered because of all that. And having satellite photos and aerial photos, that helps us find archaeological sites. I think the real difficulty is stuff that's underwater. And I've been sent some fantastic and fascinating photos by some of these Google researchers who pore over maps and find things. And some of the photos that I was sent, which I thought was pretty interesting, were photos from Google and stuff of many of these lakes in South America. And they're small mountain lakes that are in remote areas, and there's hundreds of them all through the Andes. But when you look at some of them in Google photos, it looks like there's structures in these lakes. And they're not very deep lakes. I mean, they're only maybe 30, 40 feet deep. And you can see what are geometric kind of squares and things. It's almost like there's some kind of underwater city inside these lakes. And there's also stories in South America of UFOs going in and out of these lakes. And that these lakes, some of these lakes, are these basically kind of UFO entrances to some kind of underground base. Now that kind of a thing would be extraterrestrials, or perhaps it has to do with these Vimanas and ancient humans who have this ancient aircraft, and like Mount Shasta, they've gone into underground bases. So, you know, part of the whole thing, what we were talking about earlier, was how you look at the past. And if you just see the past and the civilization of the past as being primitive and a bunch of cavemen who didn't know anything and didn't care about anything, well, then you have, like, the history that we have now, straight line graph of caveman to modern man. Here we are now. But if you look at the past of history being cycles and a roller coaster of ups and downs and ages of science and golden ages with cataclysms and crashes and we're all thrown back to the Stone Age, or most of us, I mean, that's more what my mind was going on in the past. And just like, you know, we were all concerned about in the 60s of some nuclear holocaust wiping out the whole world and there just being a few little pockets of civilization left, I mean, that's kind of what happened in the past. And that's the stories of nearly every single civilization, whether it's the Bible talking about Noah and the flood, or whether it's the Mayans or Aztecs talking about the destruction of four worlds before our own. I mean, that's what they all say, is that there were other worlds before ours, and they were destroyed in cataclysms, and then mankind rose up again, often to be destroyed one more time. And you have to wonder, even now, just, you know, how close we are to some kind of Armageddon or even just a natural disaster. I mean, I think in many ways the Earth is overdue for some giant natural catastrophe. I mean, we'll see.
Well, David, this hour has just flown by. I want to thank you so much for doing the show. And the thing I love is if you go to David's website and you check out all of his books from Adventures Unlimited Press, I mean, David can talk to you about anything.
Well, I hope people will go to my website, which is adventuresunlimitedpress.com.
That's right.
And also, you know, we have a magazine called World Explorer Magazine. It's a fun mag all about all these subjects. All color and stuff, and that's called World Explorer Magazine. And our website for that is called wexclub.com, WEXCLUB.com. That's our magazine.
That's right. There's so many places you can go. David's official website is davidhatcherchildress.com. Adventures Unlimited Press is up at adventuresunlimitedpress.com. You can head up to check out the World Explorers Club, which is at wexclub.com. And obviously, I know you're doing a lot of television shows as well. You've made a lot of appearances on Discovery Channel, the History Channel, Ancient Aliens. I mean, you've been all over the place. And is there anything...
Well, I feel lucky. I love to travel. And in fact, I'll be going to Peru at the end of June to shoot some more episodes of Ancient Aliens with Giorgio Tsoukalos, who's a good friend of mine and a great guy. So I hope your listeners will keep watching Ancient Aliens.
That's right. And I want to thank you so much for doing the show. And hopefully at some point we can get you back on, because as noted, we really only scratch the surface today of possible topics. So I know we kind of jump from one thing to another very, very quickly, but there's just so much stuff and a lot of it ties into everything else. So I want to thank you again. And we'll put links up to everything up on the front page. Make sure you check out his books. They're up available at Adventures Unlimited Press, as well as Amazon.com. A lot of them are available up there, including on the Kindle, which is where I got the Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the American Southwest. You can check that out. And David, thanks again. Best of luck with everything. And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back in just a moment with more. We're back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network, here every Friday night, 11 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern, on the Dark Matter Radio Network, streaming darkmatterradio.net. And of course, if you enjoyed that interview with David Hatcher Childress, the place to go is afterdarkradioshow.com. You can get a link to his book, my favorite book that he's written. And quite frankly, I haven't read all of his books yet, so it is my favorite at the moment. Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest. The link is up at afterdarkradioshow.com. If you click through that link, you're also help support this radio show by ordering anything off Amazon.com. So head up there to afterdarkradioshow.com, click on Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest. Check his books out. I know a lot of you are tech savvy, reading your stuff on the Kindle, and that book in particular is available on the Kindle. Believe it or not, I have the Kindle version and I have the paperback version. Not making that up. So really love that book. Really love that interview. And hopefully we can get David back on again and talk more about all of this in the future. As noted, if you'd like to contact me here tonight, my email, brian@wrestlingobserver.com. That's B-R-Y-A-N @wrestlingobserver.com. Make sure you put After Dark in the subject line. Follow me on Twitter @BrianAlvarez. And all of these, plus the phone number, 855-478-4478. All of this is up at afterdarkradioshow.com. So head up there and check that out. If you'd like to give us a call, the lines will be open until the end of the show. The phone number again, 855-478-4478. Also like to give a quick plug. If you're on Facebook, check us out at After Dark Radio Show on Facebook. My buddy Andrew has done an exceptional job on the After Dark Radio Show Facebook page. I've noted many times when I started this page, I believe I had about 400 likes. We have now passed 2,200 likes, and it's all because of Andrew. He's up there updating the Facebook page every day with brand new stories, and there's a lot of them. In fact, the most recent story that he posted from 7 hours ago was 5 Things I Learned as a Ghost Hunter from Cracked.com. If you'd like to head up there and check that out, or like us after the show, and you'll get all of this on your timeline. Now, on the topic of ghost hunting, I have a buddy whose name I'm not allowed to mention right now, but down the road, hopefully, he's going to make an appearance on this program. But this fella has become a ghost hunter, and he has sent me an email here about his first big investigation. And he has told me that I'm allowed to read this on the show, but I'm not allowed to say his name. Now, for those of you on the wrestling side of things, for those of you that subscribe to WrestlingObserver.com, my main source of income, my main business, my main radio shows, some of you know this person. So maybe down the road he will reveal himself and come onto this program. But I'm going to read this here right now. We arrived at a theater for a routine investigation and ended up having over 6 hours of direct communication with a spirit roaming this century-old theater. We use a variety of devices to gain communication, but the most successful one on this night was the REM pod, which, if your listeners are not aware, an REM pod monitors its electromagnetic environment, alerting you with sound and multicolored lights when a change has occurred. To enhance the effect, it uses a mini telescopic antenna to emit its own independent electromagnetic field around the instrument. This emitted EM field can be easily influenced by objects that conduct electricity. With all power and devices shut off that would influence this device, the only trigger to activate it are human touch or another direct form of contact. We use this to communicate with this spirit by asking it yes or no questions. Long story short, after a while of friendly communication, we noticed shadowy figures in the back near the entrance. We asked the spirit, at this time we had confirmed it was a young woman, if that was her in the back, and she responded no. We then began to ask her questions to identify these spirits. That's when things got very intense. The room, which was already dark, became black, as if you couldn't see your own hands, even after hours of your eyes adjusting. The room, which had settled on a 72.5 degree temperature all night, dropped 3 degrees within 1 minute. It was clear that whomever was in the back room did not want us there. After all was said and done, we have a story that was told to us that would make people have nightmares. We also received captured screams on audio, photos with black mists in multiple shots, and documented drops and spikes in both temperature and EMF fields. When the results are published, you can bet the After Dark audience will be privy to the amazing story this young woman told us, and we will be back to see her soon. As noted, very soon we may have that ghost hunter here on this show. Back to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Shane from Orange County.
Shane, what's up?
Hey, number one, I just want to tell you, you still do have a voicemail. You got gypped, brother.
Oh, man, I tried so hard. All right. Well, thanks for the update.
No problem. Your guest was talking about, he was saying that Tesla wanted to put electricity into the air. And I was wondering, do you have any idea what he was trying to do by putting it in the air? Was he trying to do like HARP and hopefully move, you know, weather patterns or something? Or
I don't know. I probably should ask him that the next time he comes on. I mean, the impression I got from listening to him would have been something like, I guess just broadcasting some sort of energy that everybody could pull from. I don't know if it'd be sort of like, like radio waves are picked up or cell phone. I don't know. I don't know what his idea was, but that was the impression I got, was that he would broadcast energy for us to use.
Yeah, see, that's what was tripping me out too, because that's, you know, basically what that does is shoots radio waves up and gets everything all hot. So I was wondering if maybe, you know, some nefarious parties were like, oh, hey, look, this is a good idea. Maybe we can move weather patterns with this.
So you believe that HARP is moving weather patterns?
You know, stranger things are out there. I don't know. It does seem like a really, really high-tech thing to be just out there. I don't know.
I just read the other day that HARP may be shutting down. In fact, I've actually got an article right here. U.S. military is shutting down HARP. The HARP program could be dismantled as early as this summer. So from now on, a tornado destroying your house will be a mere whirlwind, not a DARPA prank. This is from...
I guess Jesse Ventura did something helpful, huh?
Yeah, RT.com. If you want to Google it, everybody can read about HARP shutting down. So there you go.
Well, cool, Brian. Thank you very much. And how's your wrist doing, man?
It's doing a little bit better.
Yeah. Have you choked out Purple Wang lately? Or?
I have. I have gotten back to jiu-jitsu with a vengeance. I'm just being careful with it.
Well, very good. And one of these days, you got to get Wang on After Dark, because I think he'd be more, even more entertaining than on the Brian and Vinny show.
I just got to figure out what you talk about. Actually,
I think that's half the fun, is figuring out what he's going to talk about.
It is. I want to thank you very much for the call. I have a buddy named Wang, and I've had him on the other show. And now that I think about it, I don't know how interesting he would be talking about this topic, but Wang is a cancer survivor. He got leukemia, and he's good as new right now. I mean, he beat it. And it's funny because the way he tells a story, I mean, he downplays it to an amazing degree. I mean, the idea that somebody beat cancer, I mean, that to me is like a big deal, a big story. And the way Wang explains it, he's just like, I got really sick and I went to the hospital and I didn't do anything. The doctors took care of everything. So no story. But he really downplays it. But I think it would be pretty interesting to talk to him about that. Maybe I can talk him into getting him on the show here someday. He definitely loves doing shows. He's our entertainment correspondent on the wrestling show. He's talking about what's going on in the latest awards shows and that sort of thing. And indeed, I do choke him out in my jiu-jitsu class, which is, in fact, it's a stress reliever, you know what I mean? What else do we have here in the news? My wife is constantly asking me What's the latest on the plane? MH370, Malaysian Airlines flight MH370. Actually, hasn't asked me in a little while. I don't know if it's now just she's just concluded it will never be found or what, but she was following the story very, very closely and was always asking for an update, and no updates were coming. This from VOA News. Australian authorities have concluded the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 did not crash in the area of the southern Indian Ocean where electronic signals were detected last month. The estimation was made Thursday following the final mission of a miniature unmanned submarine that was scanning the ocean floor off the southwest coast of Australia. In a statement, the Joint Agency Coordination Center said the Bluefin 21 submarine found no signs of aircraft debris during its search of 850 square kilometers of ocean floor. It said the Australian Transport Safety Board has made a professional judgment that the area can, quote, now be discounted as the final resting place of the airplane. So where is it? Where is this airplane at? That has led us to the Mirror, which has now published an article, 17 conspiracy theories after the Australians say the plane is not in the Indian Ocean search area. I am not going to read this entire article, but here are a list of some of the conspiracy theories as it relates to this airplane. Now, this one here, the plane was shot down during military ops. Here's a conspiracy about rapper Pitbull, who it claims here predicted that flight MH370 would go missing 2 years ago. In his song here, which features a guest appearance from Shakira, of all people, so that might be a video to watch, include the lines, now it is off to Malaysia, as well as two passports, three cities, two countries, one day. I don't know if that necessarily would count as a solid prediction for the disappearance of this airplane, but apparently that's all over YouTube. A U.S. military base conspiracy. The United States have been forced to flatly deny claims that the plane landed at its military base on the remote island of Diego Garcia. Which actually, when I read this one, this was pretty interesting. This theory. Apparently there was like a photograph. Someone claimed that they had taken the picture there. It ended up on an internet board, if I recall the story correctly. And people presumed that it must be a hoax, but apparently there was some data that they were able to extract from the photo that showed it was, in fact, taken somewhere near Diego Garcia. So that was a very interesting story right there. Others include MH370 hid behind another plane, alien abduction, and many more. So you can check this out at themirror.co.uk, MH370, 17 Conspiracy Theories. Back to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Laura calling from Texas.
Laura, what's going on?
Well, I was really disappointed that, you know, you had your big brush with fame on Friday and we didn't get to hear the guy about the BTK killer.
Well, he's coming up next week.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. But I was wondering, have you heard about this new book this guy has written saying that his father is a Zodiac killer?
I have not. Tell me about it.
It's a great book. It's called The Most Dangerous Animal of All, and it's by a guy named Gary Stewart. And Gary was adopted at birth and started doing a search to find his birth parents. And when he did, he uncovered some evidence that his father was a Zodiac killer. And, you know, and I was really kind of skeptical about the book, but he has me convinced. He even went to the San Francisco PD and tried to give them his DNA and worked with the head of homicide. But ironically, his birth mother married one of the lead investigators on the case long after she, you know, ditched his dad. And he thinks that the San Francisco Police Department is covering up the connection. And it's creepy because he looks like his father, who looks exactly like the sketch. And he also has the cryptograms in the book where, you know, the Zodiac always said his name was in the cryptograms, and mm-hmm. this guy points out his father's name in the cryptograms.
Really?
It's really cool. You ought to see if you can get him on the show, but I haven't seen any interviews with him anywhere, and I'm just wondering if he's not giving them, but maybe you can ask your producer to take a look into it, because it is just mind-blowing.
I'm looking at the book right now. It's up on Amazon.com, The Most Dangerous Animal of All. I'm actually going to tweet this out to everybody in a moment here. New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, so, it's a great book.
All right. Well, listen, I'm going to, I will pass this on to my producer, who actually is quite amazing. So if anybody can get him on the show, it would be my producer, Garrett. So I'll
I really hope that somebody will get him on the show. They did a little bit of pre-publicity on the book, but I haven't seen this guy anywhere, so I'm wondering. And the book was ghostwritten, so I'm not really sure if he's granting interviews. But, boy, I'd really like to hear the one thing the book kind of didn't really explain to me is why his father quit, if his father really is the Zodiac, why he quit killing. He moved out of the country. I won't give too much of the book away. But he moved out of the country, and he used that as an explanation. But, you know, it seems like there would have been a lot of other murders in the parts of the world where he was, you know. But anyway,
So his father still alive?
No, he's dead.
Okay.
He died, I believe, in the mid-80s.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think, the last Zodiac murder was, 77, 78, somewhere in there.
So...
maybe.
Does he write anything in the book about, perhaps when the people, if there is a cover-up, when these people are pass away or whatever, maybe at some point this could come out? Or, I mean, does he have some sort of conclusion about where he thinks this could go? Does he have any hope that at some point?
Well, he gave his DNA to the San Francisco Police Department. He gave his DNA directly to the head of homicide and was working with them. And then suddenly the guy just quit returning his calls. And his stepfather is dead. The guy who had been one of the lead investigators had married his birth mother, but he still believes that they're holding it up. He said that they have a partial 4 or 5 point DNA sample from who they believe is the Zodiac. I think I'm not really remembering if it was from a stamp or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the test they were going to do, they were going to run his DNA, his birth mother's DNA, and then that partial sample to see if perhaps, they said they could get a match based on that, if his dad was, in fact, the Zodiac.
Well.
But I've always just been fascinated by that case. It's one of the creepier serial killer murderers that, we've ever experienced in the United States. And so, the BTK is pretty scary, but... when they never catch one, it's always somebody that's really of interest to me. So I just thought I'd point that out just in case it might be something that you guys might be able to get on the down the road. And I love the show, by the way. I think you do a great job, and you're a great interviewer, and I really appreciate your time tonight.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it, and I will get Garrett on that.
Okay, great.
All right, thanks so much for calling in. I should mention, by the way, that... my mom is a huge true crime aficionado in terms of reading all the books, and part of that may be because I believe, hopefully I don't have these details wrong here, but I believe she went to high school with the Green River Killer. So when I was a little kid, all sorts of true crime books littering the house. So there you go. The Most Dangerous Animal of All, Searching for My Father and Finding the Zodiac Killer is the name of the book. Gary L. Stewart is the author. And you can just go to my Twitter at Brian Alvarez. And I have a link to the page on Amazon.com. It is available in hardcover, Kindle, paperback, audio CD, audible book, etc. So head up there and check that out. And yes, next week... we are going to be discussing BTK. I Survived BTK is the name of the documentary. And I watched it on, it's on Netflix right now. If you want to go up to Netflix, it's on Netflix streaming. So you can go up there and watch it on your television, and the director is going to be on this program next week. We're going to be talking all about the story of Charlie Otero, who was his family. They were the first victims of the BTK killer. And interestingly enough, as this documentary was being created, at the time when they first began filming, BTK was still a mystery. He had not been captured. Mark D. Levitz, the producer who will be on the show next week, he started this. He had an idea for the whole thing. But the BTK killer, I mean, it was still a mystery. He had his whole idea in his mind about how he's going to interview Charlie and deal with this whole situation. So as they were filming, the BTK killer was caught. And so everything in terms of filming this documentary was kind of thrown into disarray because they actually found the guy. So we're going to be talking to him next week, Mark Levitz. It's going to be a good time, and I guess as good a time as you can have talking about the BTK killer. But that'll be next week on the program, so you can all look forward to that. We are running low on time, everybody. We're going to wrap this show up. I want to thank all of you very much for listening. I know that over the past couple months, I've had a lot of things going on that have caused me to have to air replays. So I do apologize for that. It is summertime, and there's a lot of things going on. And traditionally over the summer, the After Dark Radio Show has been, well, sometimes we have a lot of replays. I will do the best I can, and there's a lot of great replays, by the way, that will be playing if I'm not going to be around. But I will be here next week for sure. I have no film scheduled or anything like that. I have nothing to do except this program. So next week, I survived BTK. And of course, in the meantime, there's a lot of great stuff for you. If you missed the most recent show, you can head up to After Dark Radio, May 10, 2014. Chris Savia of The Anomalist, one of my favorite websites. He was on the program. That is up there right now for download. But you better get there quick, because in about 15 minutes, it's gone. It'll be replaced with this program. But head up there and check that out. I love The Anomalist. Everything you ever wanted to know about The Anomalist is covered with this Chris Savia interview. So head up there and check that out at the AfterDarkRadioShow.com website. You can also check out David Hatcher Childress's book. It's up there. Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest, one of 21 books he has written. That is up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And of course, you can check out the Facebook page, updated all the time by my good buddy, Andrew. You can head up there and check that out. It's on Facebook, After Dark Radio Show on Facebook. Join the fun. Like the page. We've got 2,246 as of right now. Hopefully we'll have more in the morning. So head up there. And of course, ArtBell.com, the main website for the Dark Matter Radio Network. Check out ArtBell.com. And of course, a lot of great programming on DarkMatterRadio.net. In fact, live programming throughout the week. A lot of great programs. This show will be replaying tomorrow, as well as many others. Capricorn Radio, 5 o'clock p.m., Dreamland, Restricted Airspace, and The Secret Teachings, all on Saturday. And that is just one day out of the week, so check that out. It's available on TuneIn Radio if you search Art Bell or After Dark Radio Show or Dark Matter Radio Network. I believe you can search all of those, and you'll find them on TuneIn Radio, my favorite way to listen to the Dark Matter Radio Network. So we're out of here, everybody. I want to thank you again for listening. Back next week talking the BTK killer. And as always, have a good week. We'll talk to you again after a while.